infielder, was it Nellie Fox?
No, it wasn't Nellie. After Nellie had gone. And later he went to the...
Aparicio?
No. He later went on to New York Mets the year they won the pennant, and he hit pretty good, did a real good job. Anyhow, I remember the writers called up right away, "What are you letting him hit for?" He says, "He represents the tie and run." And he says, "And if he can get on, we can operate."
Mm-hmm.
And he says, "And if he doesn't get on, we can't operate." You know.
Mm-hmm.
So he says, "I can hit and run with him. I can move him over. I can score him. I don't have to use a man for him." See? Which,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
See? Now here comes a guy. Comes a guy in after the game is over, comes into the clubhouse, and he asks Al the same question. But the way he asked him, Jesus, Al got mad. He said, "Write what you damn please." He said, "But don't come in here."
Yeah, I've seen writers that they ask a question like they're second guessing you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They're not trying to learn.
Yeah.
They're trying to teach you.
Oh, yeah.
I want to go back. One of my interests is Connie Mack. Did you ever have any contact with Connie Mack?
No.
But you had a pitcher in 36 with Brooklyn, George Earnshaw.
Oh, geez, yeah, we, yeah.
What do you remember that George Earnshaw was like, and did he ever talk about his days with Connie Mack?
No, not, he'd talk about him, but I can't remember some of the things he'd say. Because, you know, when he was over at Connie Mack, God, what a machine they had.
Yeah.
You know, in those days. Anyhow, here's the funniest thing. He could sneak in a spitter every once in a while. He had a little separation of his teeth in the front. He could, and a lot of times when we'd work together, and a lot of times when you had somebody on two strikes and he wanted to use that spitter, I knew what he was going to do because we'd come back and give him a fastball sign and give him a chance to decide whether he wanted to throw the spitter or not. And he'd waste the ball way up here. Then I'd get it and throw it back, and he tried to have it come back like to his face where he could have his glove like this, and when the ball couldn't go, he'd get it and he'd catch the ball, and then he'd... And he pulled that. We were playing an exhibition game in the spring, and he pulled that on Gehrig with the bases loaded. Jesus Christ, and he really broke one off with it. And the gentleman and everything that, what's the name was, Lou was, he says, "You SOB." He says, "But boy, that wasn't that a dandy." Oh. George was funny. Oh, geez, George was funny. That little separation in his teeth allowed him to hit those little BBs, and he could get those BBs in there and pop you. We'd go to a show, and God, we'd have everybody, and he'd be sitting there watching me, and he'd pop you. You know, and we stayed in New Orleans. I can't think of the name of the hotel. But there was a lady with her hat, nice, beautiful hat, and reading the newspaper, you know. But he'd sit like about over there, and pop, the newspaper would go. She'd get back to read, pop another one. Finally, she put the newspaper down, and he started working on that hat. Finally, she got up and left. But that used to be funny as hell.
I'm sure that he did that in his days with Philadelphia.
Oh, yeah. We go to a hotel to check in or something. He popped his gun. He was looking at her. The guy probably blinked and turned his head.
And she's using BBs?
Yeah, there's little BBs.
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus. I would laugh myself sick. I had to get away from him a lot of times, you know, because somebody knew something was wrong. But that'd be funny in the theater. You pop that thing in it.
Who were your roommates?
Well, my first year up, I roomed with Al Lopez once for him. Casey thought that, you know, he could impart some knowledge, mm-hmm. which he did. He was very helpful with me. And, where did I go from there?
Well, with Pittsburgh.
Yeah, I went to Pittsburgh, and I roomed with Red Lucas quite a bit. Real nice guy. That hair lip and all, God, he was funny. He kept me loose all the time. Yeah.
Sounds like Jim Bagby, same
yeah,
type.
Same mm-hmm. type. And you really, you know, you shouldn't laugh, but it makes it funny. Then over at Boston, when Spawn first come up, I roomed with him quite a bit. Well, because I was all through then, that's when I was an emergency man. I was hanging around in case something happened, and I was working with the pitchers.
And with the Giants?
In the Giants, I roomed with Bill Werber for a long time. And then I roomed with Mungo. Oh, and that was something.
Yeah, you know, Mungo would come in at night.
Mm-hmm. A real good guy, but he couldn't take a sip at what he'd get belligerent or wanted to do something, have some mm-hmm. fun. But it happened quite often. He'd come in and he'd call for room service, and he had that real Carolina brogue, you know, sound like a mush mouth. And with a drink that he had in him, he'd call for room service, and they couldn't understand him. And he'd get mad, tear that phone off the wall.
I think it was Mickey Wittig told me that he would come in like 2:00 in the morning, bang on the door to get in, and there was doors between the rooms.
Yeah,
and they'd barricade it.
That would be in St. Louis a lot of times. They'd have a suite of rooms.
Yeah, they'd barricade it with the bureau and chair and whatever to keep him out.
He was something.
Mm-hmm.
But gosh, he had a heart as big as gold. When I was over in New York with him, we had Danny Gardella. If he'd have stayed around, he'd been one of baseball's greatest characters.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, he was something else. Well, he'd get Danny to do anything. Danny was one of those guys that would. He liked to carry the flag and make speeches in Central Park in New York. Sometimes he'd be late, sometimes he'd fail to come. But every once in a while he'd do something at the psychological moment, like hit a home run to win a ball game.
Mm-hmm.
And what's his name? Would hit him too. Mel would get after him once in a while. One time he came late in Philadelphia. He was playing with the kids in the street in the park in New York, Central Park, until all of a sudden he wound up thinking, Jesus, it's not an off day, they're playing. Well, he came up and the game was over by the time he got there. So Mel gave him hell. And they had a real nice fashionable dining room, you know, with the maitre d' and everybody and seats, you know. In comes Danny, he looked like a bum. Today they let you in, you know, wearing mm-hmm. a shirt, you don't have. But there he had to wear a coat and tie. Danny didn't have a coat and tie. So he gets in an argument with the mayor, and Mel is sitting back at his table, and he has to get up and send Danny back to the room. He says, "You got a coat and a tie?" "Yeah, I got a coat and a tie. Well, put it on to eat in here." So he goes up to the room, and he's been rooming with Johnny Gee, he'd reached his ceiling. Big, tall guy.
Yeah, 6'9".
Yeah, big, tall. So he put this shirt on and wrapped a tie around, wrapped it to where it was all knot, you know, just a little nub sticking out. And he put Johnny Gee's sports coat on and came down. And now the maitre d' is there, and he doesn't know what in the heck to do. And Danny says, "Are they any better than I am?" Maitre d' says, "No." He says, "Well, then you'll seat me now." He says, "I got a coat and tie on." Jeez. Mel saw him, and Mel got mad. He says, "Danny, if you want to stay in this ball club, if you want to keep from being fined $500, you go up to your room and stay there." So he goes up to his room, and he's got a corner room, And now we're all sweet, and Mungo and I were standing outside of a bunch of other players, and we finally, Danny comes to the window and he hollers down, "I'm a prisoner of baseball." and Mungo would say, "Ah, come on down." He says, no, he says, "I'm locked in my room." He said, "Well, go slide down that rain pipe." And just kind of window over. So he gets out and he hangs on by his fingers on the thing. He gets over and comes down that rain pipe. Mel got mad and hell at him and sent him home.
Is it true that the players was not a good manager? He didn't have the respect of the players as a manager?
I think after following McGraw, see, I was there his first year he managed, and I was there with him for 4 years. I think after McGraw, after Bill Terry, came Mel, mm-hmm. and the club wasn't doing too well.
Yeah.
We got off to a pretty good start, and we went into one horrible slump. And I think the pressure mounted. It kept mounting. Then he finally wound up with Mize and Lombardi and myself. And we just didn't have a real good club.
It was a pretty old club by then.
Yeah,
it was
a pretty old club by then. And he was a real good competitor anyway, to begin with, Mel was. And I suppose he thought this competitiveness would go out onto the players. Mm-hmm. Well, they had some recalcitrance, you know. Some young guys, they weren't getting a chance. They were bitching and griping.
Somebody told me that he used to go out after games with Hubble, and when he became a manager, he couldn't do that anymore.
Well, that could have been.
And he didn't want anybody else going out with him. And he said he passed a rule that Hubble and I think Cliff Melton couldn't leave the clubhouse together.
Oh, I never heard that.
And so
I was there 4 years and never heard that.
I think this was Cliff Melton who told me. So they used to meet somewhere else.
Well, it might have been, but I don't remember him ever hearing him say that. Mm.
But it was making that transition from player to manager at the same time.
And then playing at the same time.
Yeah.
It took a lot out of him.
Yeah. Did you say that you were in the bullpen all the time you were pitching coach?
Yeah.
But they don't do that now.
No. Uh-huh. They go watch computers or something.
Well, they're always on the bench.
Yeah, well,
charting, keeping charts. And
we kept charts. So I was the one that started that business. But I started it for a convincing thing. Like I'd have difficulty with you, changing something, changing your style a little. Not necessarily your style, but your delivery a little bit. Like keeping you from rushing, like I was demonstrating to you a minute ago. And when you slip out of that, I'd mark that pitch. I got rid of all of those things too. I had little squares for each hitter, see? And then I had a number, like one with fastball, and I'd mark where it was, and so on. And when you made this bad pitch, I'd mark that pitch, see? And then as you continued, and you'd come out of it, and as you continued and started getting into it more frequently, that's when I would talk to the manager and say, "Hey, I think we better get somebody ready because he's slipping back into his old way." And so when it become more and more, we'd get him out of there.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of times they'd wonder why. And if they got in an argument, I'd show them, "Look, here's where it started." And after that, it was a convincing thing for me, and it helped me to prove a point. And I had, and at home, especially at home where our bullpen was, I could whistle to the center fielder who would probably whistle to the shortstop. We had signals. I'd get your attention and turn your, and the pitcher would look out at me on the mound. And
you were doing all this charting from the bullpen?
From the bullpen.
Yeah.
See, then we had the fence.
Which wasn't that far away.
Yeah,
you know?
We had that fence there. And when Tommy was pitching, I'd lean on the fence. And when he'd get, instead of laying here, and when he'd get doing this, I'd get his attention. And then he'd look out at me, and I'd just slide myself like this, just a little bit. Nobody knew what it was except me. And we had another pitcher that was the goofiest thing you ever saw. Every time he wanted to throw a fastball, he'd throw his head like that. And when he'd do that, I'd have to stop him because I was afraid they're going to read him. See, and then he'd look back out there and I'd go, stay in there. You see, all these little things.
So you were never the guy who would walk out to them and have the conference on the mound?
No, no. I talked to him right, if we got out of the inning all right, I talked to him on the phone.
Uh-huh.
But it got so where, you know, they start, I said, you start, don't you feel that in your arm? They start feeling it in the arm when they feel that little tension. They know what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they turn around and look at me out there themselves.
Now they do it by going out to the mound. And
yeah, another way. Jesus, one day we're playing in Cleveland, and oh, were they creaming Billy Pierce. And I said, Jesus, that can't be. I warmed them up and the stuff he had. All of a sudden, I started looking for something. And Billy, at that, I have to do it right-handed. All of a sudden, here he'd be on his fastball. He'd come up, you know, lock back, get his fastball there. And on the curveball, he'd come up. See, instead of coming up this way, he'd come up this way for the curve. In other words, this would be a fastball. As he'd grip his fastball this way, he'd turn his hand this way for the curve. And one of those hitters could get that. That was a fastball. That was the curve. He'd come up this way. Now he got out of that, and they had him another way. He'd come up like this, see, fastball. Now he'd come up, and he'd go back here for the curve. You get that? See that little difference?
Yeah.
Bob Turley was great at it. He could sit on the bench for the New York club and call a lot of the pitchers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had that faculty, too, from watching.
Yeah. But some of them didn't want to know.
Oh, you're bothering me, you know. But I said, what the hell? That bothering you? I said, what the hell do you think they're doing to me? You're bothering me, too. And that manager in there. But it must have changed. I haven't been around it. I don't watch it. I have nobody. See, I'm out here in the country. I don't have anybody to. Once in a while, I only go to maybe one game a year or so.
Yeah, the pitching coach is on the phone to the bullpen, and he's the guy who goes out to the mound for the conferences.
Yeah.
Not to take the pitcher out, but.
Sometimes just to give that guy 8 or 10 more pitches in the bullpen.
Do you recall, do any pitchers stand out either from when you were playing or coaching, who could win on losing teams but not with winners?
Yeah, but I'm not going to mention their names. I'll have some repercussions.
Any deceased ones?
Yeah. No, but they might have some grandchildren or something. No, I'd hate to have somebody.
Yeah.
See, like my guy growing up, all he heard was me being kidding about being a lousy hitter. They never, and the writers did the same thing to me.
Mm-hmm.
They never realized that it was my defensive work that kept me around.
Mm-hmm.
And Clyde Mylan says, this is going to be your life. And you're not going to be a star player, but you'll be.
Calling a game is more important.
Yeah, he says, and don't forget, well, like Mylan told me one day, he says, Ray, don't ever forget it. He says, every stage play needs stage hands.
Did you ever want to manage?
I tried it one year and I hated it.
Yeah, I was wondering about that.
You know, I could hire you, but I couldn't fire you. It just, in the same way with coaching. When I couldn't get across to somebody, it would just drive me nuts. I could sleep pretty good. See, I commuted. And by the time I got home, I was physically tired.
Uh-huh.
I wouldn't think about some of this, and it wore off. Well, anyway, and that was about a 70-mile stretch. I was 140 miles a day, average.
Uh-huh.
So, anyway, I'd sleep pretty well at night. See, I had that home over on the lake over there, and I'd either come home and go for a little short swim, a dive or two, and then come in. Or I had a buddy there that would wait for me once in a while. We'd go out and catch a fish fresh. Well, anyway, I'd sleep pretty good until maybe about 2 o'clock in the morning, and here we come, this thing. And I'd be thinking, what can I do? And I'd walk the floor. I couldn't go back to sleep. And the same thing happened during spring training. when it came to a disbursement meeting, oh, you have to tell somebody that we can't use you. You know that it's, they got a family, you know that, you know, that maybe they don't have the ability. And the thing that bothered me was the guy that gave it this, the most, that you knew it couldn't make it. And God, it just literally broke my heart there. Unfortunately, the managers did most of it. But I'd have to acquiesce. I'd have to...
in the meeting, you got to give an opinion.
Yeah, I had to give an opinion. Like getting back to Paul Richards one time, when Paul first took the club over in 51, he didn't care for Billy Pierce, or Nellie Fox. Nellie, he wasn't the classiest of first base, of second basemen.
Uh-huh.
He didn't make the double play that well because he didn't have the arm. And his hitting, he hit about 257 the year before, and I told Paul, he's a gamester, he'll play every day. Anyhow, he says, we had a dispersal meeting. Frank Lane sat here, Richard sat there. I still see where they were sitting. Doc Kramer sat there. What the hell is his name? Harris sat there, coach, and another coach sat there. And when it came to Nelly, I blocked it. All of them said, what's his name? One of the guys says, oh, he's a ping hitter. I said, yeah, but he doesn't strike out. And he'll play every day for you. I said, you can't hurt him. And I said, you haven't got a replacement for him, anybody that's as good as he is. I said, I wouldn't make the deal. And Richards got madder than hell at me. He says, I've got him traded to Portland. He says, we haven't completed the deal, the signing or anything, but God, was he mad.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, we brought in, and I said to him, he said, why do you like him so well? And I added a couple more things. I says, you play for your hurt and you'll never know it. And I says, and if by the end of spring training you dislike him and still want to make the deal, okay. I said, but you've got to see this guy every day. I said, he'll play for you if he's got to play in the crutches. Don't you know the first exhibition game that we played, the first ball that was hit to him took a bad hop and hit him right in the mouth. And he turned around and spit those two broken teeth out, spit them out. He was bleeding like a pig, and he wadded his mouth up with a chewing tobacco that he ought to have. So I sat there and watched him, and I'd see him turn around, kind of spit blood, you know, to the center field. And I said, Paul, you're going to have to get him out of there. He said, well, I get him out of there. He said, it's only the first inning. I said, he's spitting teeth and spitting blood. But finally, he had to get him out, and Nellie put up a fuss. But before the year was over, then we brought in, Paul brought in Joe Gordon to show him how to make the pivot and to cheat a little bit, you know.
Uh-huh.
And then we had all the infielders working, throwing the ball to the inside part of the bag, which would only, not only shorten them up, but give them a better chance to cheat. Like if the ball got over here, he couldn't throw you out because he couldn't get turned around. So it taught him to come in here and go from here. Lots of times he'd be off the bat.
Yeah.
But it became such a good habit, it looked like a dancer out there.
Yeah. So, phantom tag.
Yeah.
Clark Griffith didn't think much of Nellie Fox either.
Oh, and then we had Dorish. His name come up in the meeting. And
Harry Dorris?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He came up to me. I says, I'll keep him. Lane says, what? I says, I'll keep him. He said, you son of a bitch. You know, he cussed like hell anyway. You son of a bitch, he says. Now, what do you like about him? So one of the coaches says, well, he says, he's a Pollock, and Ray likes Pollock. It was just a breakup because he thought we'd get a laugh out of him. Frank didn't laugh that often. Finally, he says, now you give me about a half a dozen reasons why you like him. I says, I'd like him if he's the 10th pitcher on the club. For number one, when he's very cooperative. Whatever you ask of him, he'll do. He'll never mumble. He'll never complain. And I said, the next thing I like about him, He's got his glove and ball ready if you call him. Boom, boom. I says, the other guys, you got to call them, got to hunt for their glove and all that crap. Or who, me? I got to go in there. Mm-hmm. As he'll go in a tight, he'll go in to mop up, he'll do anything. Well, anyhow, the things didn't go through. And we kept them. And then we're working out one day in an armory. We came back north to Chicago and there's weather like this almost. So we're working out in the armory and I was always fiddling around with pitches and things, and Paul was too. He was ambidextrous, he could throw left-handed as well as right. They were always working on deliveries. He had a freak thing that I never saw anybody throw. It looked like the ball come up to you and back up. It was really an unorthodox thing, but it's funny. So I had a goofy pitch. I threw back to him, and Paul, lackadaisically, he reached for it, and it broke, and it hit him on the shin. Jeez, they weren't jumping around, and he was mad. He looked at me. You know how Paul could look at you. And finally, he says, come over. He says, hey, Ray, if there's any experiment to be done, he says, I'll experiment. And he says, by the way, he says, how'd you throw that? And I showed him. He says, show it to me again. And he was ready for it. And we got together again. He says, that is the pitch that kept Mitchell at New Orleans when he was an old man. The damn thing would just come up to you and go, you know, and it bounced, and the guys would hit, swing at it, and miss, because it was an optical illusion. And don't you know, Doris picked it up, and he became one of the best relief pitchers, closeout men, you know, at that time. So everything was hunky-dory.
You had a system then where if one of the guys in the meeting said, keep him,
it had to be unanimous.
That's
what was Frank.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Dodgers used to do that too.
Yeah. You see, sometimes one person can see something but another one, and it might be a foolish little thing.
Yeah.
Shoot, I had a kid show me one time. We had Eddie Fisher, a knuckleball pitcher, and everybody knew when it was coming, and I didn't realize what the heck, you know, why. All of a sudden, I'm in the bullpen, and his fastball would be like this, and his curveball would be like this, and as soon as he had to get that fist over the knuckleball, he had to spread the fingers out in the glove. See?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And if you don't find those things and correct them?
You played for two operators who stand out to me anyhow, McPhail and Brooklyn.
I wasn't there at the time.
34, 36?
No, yeah. He came later.
Oh, okay. He came 38, I think.
38 or somewhere in
38.
There.
38. You were still... Was running the team then?
Yeah, and, I forgot who... Singer was a manager, of course.
Who were you dealing with in contracts?
Oh... No, I can't think of his name. And then they hired somebody that must have been one of the relatives or something. They had made him the general manager. And he didn't last long. He didn't know too much about it.
Mm. I think, well, the bank took it over
there.
I mean, they didn't have any money
no.
at all.
Bob Quinn was there. Bob Quinn.
And then he was later in Boston.
Boston, yeah.
And the Giants, Horace Stoneham, you were dealing with.
Yeah, Horace Stoneham.
And with the White Sox, somewhere in there, you were working for Bill Veeck, right?
Yeah, Bill never, I never went up to the office. I rarely ever see Bill or talk to him, you know. See, I stayed away from all of that. I stayed away from, I'm talking more now than I did in 44 years in the game. I stayed away from writers.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I didn't, I disliked them. Number one, I didn't care for publicity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just, what the heck? Because all as a player, all I got was adverse publicity. You know.
but if a writer would approach you and ask you questions
but,
or something, about a pitcher or something.
I would never run a pitcher down. That's his bread and butter.
Yeah.
And you don't know how that thing got blown out. Now, if I gave you a story and another one come along, you gave him a story, how, you know, then you're in trouble. And I says, anything that I have to say, anything that I see, I relay it to the manager. Uh-huh. Now, if he wants to tell you, fine. And I had a good rapport with him. They understood it.
Yeah.
I said, I'm just not the man to tell you these things. Manager might not like it either.
Would you
and
read?
Maybe the owners wouldn't like it.
Yeah. Would you read the sports pages?
Yeah. I like to see what... sometimes a little comment might be made. Some guy might be hot, some guy cold, you know, coming in.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I had... As you see right now, I'm having a difficult time with remembering names. I was never very good at remembering names.
We're only going back 60 years.
But, so. No, I'm just grasping for words every once in a while. But if I saw you walk those stairs, 100 years from now, I can tell you how you walked those stairs. And the same way with pitchers. I could associate you with every game that I ever saw you pitch, or anybody. I used to be able to call pitches when, I can't think of his name again. Pitched for the Yankees, White Sox, and lives in Connecticut. Big, big name pitcher. I saw him as a kid. He broadcast. He was with New York Mets for a while, years ago. Oh, a real prominent name.
Oh, wait a minute. You saw him when he was a kid.
Yeah.
Oh, Seaver.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I got to where I could call his pitchers. And especially when he had the sore arm. Every time that he was going to throw a real good fastball, he was ahead of you. No, I'm going to have a little difficulty. He'd get down in here too much. He'd get back. He'd go bare back a little
uh-huh.
bit. And when he was throwing his breaking ball, he was more pivotal.
Uh-huh.
When he goes really throw that hard one, he just that little pitch. I'm surprised nobody ever saw that.
Well, when he was with the White Sox, that was after your time.
That was long ago.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually, my last year with the big club was in 69, and I went into the farm system in 70, and that drove me nuts. Those kids wanted to do something their own way. I said,
mm-hmm.
You can't do it that way. He said, well, how come I was successful in college or high school, you weren't facing the same people that would see you every day.
The coaches say the same thing today. I hear it all the time.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Just drive me nuts. And I said, holy cow.
They want to do what they see on television.
Yeah.
And you just can't tell them.
Oh, I saw a good-looking little high school catcher, and the coach said something about he doesn't do this or that, and I said, well, so I went to show him a little easier way. He says, that's not the way I see it on television.
Uh-huh.
I says, you know something? The one part of the game that's going back fast and faster than any other is the catching. That has really gone back. Well, I don't mind one-handed, but they're one-handed when the guy is running. And the thing of it is, the way they're catching, I go call them an ostrich. Their butt up in the air and their head in the grass. Instead of being this way, you know, and this way, they're like this. Now if the ball's over here, they fall. I'll guarantee you, I'll shake hands with you. And I'll shake hands with you over there. Now you throw a fastball over there, you throw a fastball over there, I'm going to get it.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'll knock it down. Why? Because I'm like this. And when the ball's over there, I'm there. And if it's over here, I'm here.
Yeah.
In the same way the guys that are down like this and the ball is up here, it goes back to the stands. Jeez, I go nuts. The worst part is, I see them run, they even do it on a pitch out. They'll take that one hand, and maybe they won't grab it there, they grab it everything on the side of it. Now, the ball's over here, pitch out, instead of going like this, they're going, they'll go.
Yeah.
You see the difference?
Mm-hmm.
You think you can teach that to anybody? They will not do it.
Yeah.
As you can catch one-handed. Well, you can catch one hand with your hand behind you.
Mm-hmm.
Now if the ball's in the glove, go. You don't have to go.
Yeah.
But you try to tell that to somebody.
I talked to Johnny Roseboro.
Oh, yeah.
And he was a minor league catching coach for a couple of years for the Dodgers. And just as frustrating as it could be.
Yeah, drive you nuts.
He said you the mitt, you use the mitt like a, he said, like a ping pong paddle.
Or a basket.
Like a ping pong paddle.
Yeah.
He said it's supposed to be down like this, up like this, not like this.
Inside.
But they're trying to get it like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they do, they snap at it.
Yeah.
There's another thing. This is home plate. Here comes a curveball, like I've shown you before. They're like this, back here. Here they are. They catch so much in here or on the side of them. Now they're catching that breaking ball that's coming across here, catching a good part of that corner. You think that umpire's going to call out a strike when you're catching it out here, back here? Now you see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That proves that it's a good delivery when you're down in there. See, because if you're here, you're coming through, everything is perfect. So it's a real good pitch. Now instead of catching it here, if they caught it here, this could be a strike. But if it isn't a strike, if it's called a ball, you have kept that pitcher in a good groove. Now you'll come back with another curveball because he missed there. He's liable to try to throw it to the middle of the plate, which invariably happens, and it hangs inside up in the seats.
Mm-hmm.
I go nuts watching it. I shut the damn thing off. That's right. It just bothers me to see that. I went up to Milwaukee last year. My first game I was up there. A friend of mine was in the insurance business, and he had a client that was baseball nuts. No more about me and everybody else. And it goes back to my playing days in the minors. He's an elderly fellow, you know, but they had a position for him. And they had another client along that they were working at. They asked me when I come along and make some comments. And I said, well, if I'd be of any help to you, I'd be glad to. So I went up, and this one guy says, no, I want you to look at this game in a critical fashion, you know. See and tell me what you see that I can look for myself. So I said, okay, I'll start with the catcher. And first thing I knew, I was calling all his pitches. And he says, where are you getting those from? He says, I'm watching the pitcher, I can't see anything. I said, I'm not looking at the pitcher. He says, who are you looking at? I said, the catcher. Get a catcher at Milwaukee. He'd look like he'd get down like I told you, like this. If he had a fastball sign, he'd invariably stay here, see? But his feet would stay like this.
Uh-huh.
Now if it was a curveball, he'd move up a little bit and move his feet a little bit. So I had him right away.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. And he's, oh my God. I finally told that to Garner. I saw him, I never met him, but I saw him at a baseball hot stove banquet in Kenosha. And I told him, I said, I don't know if anybody else ever saw it, but, you know, something for you to crack in spring training. He says, oh my God.
Is that Nielsen? The Australian?
Yeah. I guess they're going to play him at first base anyway on the outfield. But I mean, I saw those things. He says, God, he says, that's fun. So he started calling him, and he had everybody around him say, geez, that's an authority.
You could have the whole stands called.
Oh, they had a lot of fun. Yeah, they had a lot of fun.
Yeah, like a cheerleader.
And then there was a ball hit down in the left field corner for a double. And there's a chance to get the guy at second base. Here's your second baseman. The throw was coming in good. Your second baseman, this is the bag. The second baseman goes from here to your bag to take the throw and then dives back.
Oh, yeah.
The guy is safe. Instead of staying back here and going, boom. All right.
Every time there's a guy trying to steal second, they're back there.
Yeah.
Or up front.
Yeah.
And they got to take it and turn it.
They like that, right? They don't want to get spiked.
Yeah.
That's it exactly, yeah.
Or spectacular. I don't know which, but I think it's more spikes than anything.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Nellie Fox used to do that. But they had a hell of a time. Well, we had time correcting him.
Mm-hmm.
Every time he'd do something like that, Cuccinello was funny. He'd just go, So no, no words were exchanged, but it's a habit. And now you see the guy, the second baseman, run up like they're here coming from there. They get up in here and take the throw and come back.
Yeah.
Jesus. Remember Hanson?
Ron Hanson?
Ron.
Yeah,
oh, he was a good tiger. He'd be right at that bag.
Yeah.
On close plays.
Sure.
Well, anyway, on the same double that I was telling about, that was the tying run was there. So I said, now, quick, take a look. Where's your right fielder? I said, he's standing out there still beating his hand in the cup. I said, look at your first baseman. He's still standing there beating the cup.
Not back in the plate.
Huh?
Not back in the plate.
Not back in the plate. The ball gets away and goes into the thrower, could have gone into...
the pitcher should be back there, didn't he?
No. That first baseman's got to get in line.
You're talking about backing up the relay?
Yeah, he's backing up. The thrower's coming from left the corner in left field to the second baseman.
Yeah.
And then the second pitcher backs him up, in case of an overthrow.
Okay.
So he can't go to third. Now, in this case, if the ball got by him and went into right field along the foul line, the guy scores.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what drives me nuts is another thing, too, is the catchers. You see that throw? This is home plate, and they're coming from right field. The guy will be up here. They'll catch the ball and dive back at him or tag him with that one.
Yeah.
Jeez.
They do the same thing.
Mm-hmm. And I remember, I had to be quick because I was little. I'd block it. But you know when your throw was coming from left field and it was a good throw, I could, I could see. I'd give you that plate, give you all the plate to see. And then as soon as you came in and you start leaning to go into your slide, I could block you. And you couldn't hurt me because you couldn't get back up. I learned that right quick. Pepper Martin nailed me one time. And everything was there simultaneously. The ball and he and boy, he dove in there head first and somehow he got his hand under my chest protector and ripped that strap and that buckle part of my hair. And I said, well, there's got to be a better way than this. And from then on, I'd give him the plate and I stick my foot in there. Once I got him the slide. And the catcher should not have to be bowled over. They're not going to bowl you over because they can't get at you. And another thing I used to tell him, I said, look, when that guy, what the hell's his name, Rose, hit that catcher.
And Fossey, yeah.
Fossey, there was... I can see what catchers would do. They've got to be a gamester or you're not going to be a catcher. But when they come at you that way, that's simple as hell. You're like this, ready to just let them go by.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like a bullfighter.
Yeah. It's as simple as that. But you've got to be hurt sometimes to
think about it.
Yeah.
And Hartnett says one day to me, he says, Ray, he says, you'll never make a penny. And I says, why? He's everything you do looks so damn easy, nobody appreciates you. He's where we wall around and block the thing. He says, you go up there and catch it. So I says, thanks for the compliment.
Yeah.
And you never see plays like that runner on third base, run up and down. Wow, did I love that. Knock that hitter on his ass and pick that guy off. Because once he sees the hitter go down, he's ready to score.
Mm-hmm.
And once he's done it, you got him. You might not do it maybe 5-6 times a year, but you're liable to pull it and save yourself a ball game once in a while. But you know what it also does? It bothers that hitter.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
What was your sign for a knockdown pitch?
No, it just...
Yeah.
But you see,
is it true or is it valid to say that most stolen bases are stolen on the pitcher?
Yeah. But today it's a combination of both, like I was showing you.
Yeah.
You lose 2-3 steps and you got to make an absolute perfect throw.
Mm-hmm.
But see now.
And the second baseman's in front of the base and he's got to turn and swipe the bag.
Oh, that drives me nuts. Drives me, we should be right like that.
Who's the best scout you ever saw?
Scout? God, I don't know. I didn't meet too many, but these are so darn many of them. I had thousands of them, it looked like, in a book that I had back there. I really couldn't tell you. I probably will after you're gone.
I'll call you.
Yeah.
Were there any scouts in the White Sox organization when you were coaching early, before the draft days, who had the more respect, whose opinions were...
Yeah, they were highly regarded.
Yeah.
And their job depended on it, too. Well, there was no farm system or anything. You had to find them any place you could find them.
Yeah.
You'd find them on sand lots sometimes, but you don't have sand lots anymore.
Well, but back in the early 50s, you know, all through the 50s when you were coaching, were there any White Sox scouts then who commanded more respect than others?
We had a guy out on the West Coast. Jeez. Can see him, but can't think of his name. He was highly regarded. When they had a big deal going, he would be the one that would perhaps close the deal, like a salesman. They can get so far with somebody that they can't sign them. And then recommend you players for trades and stuff like that. That's a big, important thing. See, but I got to see very few of them. There was another thing that bothered me as a coach. They probably saw a pitcher that they liked, and maybe were in their minor leagues for a year or two, or maybe brought up to have a look at right now. You'll see if there's a lot of money involved. Well, if you turn somebody down, what do they look like in the eyes of the owner?
Uh-huh.
And if they sign somebody, and they got a lot of money invested in them, and I can't use them, or it doesn't fit in with our plans, then the owners could be on my back.
Uh-huh.
But I'm always thinking of that poor coach that stuck his neck out. So
yeah.
I got to please the owner, I got to please the coach, I got to please the manager, I got to please myself.
Uh-huh.
What if you balled in?
And the thing that it didn't bother me so much when the guy was a smart aleck. Well, I'm going to do it my way or else. I said, all right, your else is going to be elsewhere too.
Uh-huh.
And I told him, I said, look, this is going to happen. Well, I'm talking about the tough guy that he couldn't do. This is going to happen, and this is going to happen, and this is going to happen. And when it does, if you're still in the organization, come back to me. I'd be glad to go over it all.
Uh-huh.
But in the meantime, I won't bother you any longer. But you'll get a chance to prove that your way is wrong. Oh, and this one smart left-hander we had, geez, he had good stuff. Had much better stuff than Tommy John. But I couldn't convince him. Could not convince him. And I said, you're going to stay in the minors. You aren't going to get away with it up there. I said, those right-handers are going to kill you into right field. Now, this is in spring training, mind you.